Sup, fools? Today's podcast is brought to you by the kind folks that contribute to me on Patreon. Patreon is a service that allows you to donate a monthly recurring sum to my podcast, which I appreciate very much. It is the one thing that keeps this podcast going, and I want to shout out my patrons before we get started today. Also, I want to let you know that all patrons submitted to me between now, today's October 1st, and October 10th, so anybody that donates to the podcast over Patreon over the next 10 days, I'm going to match 50% of those Patreons, and they will be sent to, and not only that, but my friend Russ Valenti, who is also a patron, will match my match, and that sum is going to be donated to the causes at Traders for a Cause, which is the Las Vegas conference I will be speaking at in 2 weeks in Las Vegas. Traders for a Cause this year benefits the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, Honor Flight Southern Nevada, the Parkinson's Association, Twin Cities Lyme Foundation, which I know is Pete Najarian's Lyme Foundation, I believe, and PCRF, and The Life You Can Save. So you get a chance to help out your favorite podcast and donate to some incredible causes at the same time. I'm going to shout out my patrons, then we're going to get this thing rolling. First and foremost, my friends over at The Traders Path. The Traders Path is a brand new investor education and investor advocacy service made specially for day traders. The service was started by a guy who got fed up with day trading services that he was a part of. So he said, forget about it. I'm going to start my own. They offer daily watch lists. They offer live commentary, a daily live stream for day traders, a chat room, investor education, tons of stuff. So check out the Traders Path. The link is in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my good friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. These guys dedicate all of their time to following the big money in the options market that hopefully will precede moves in equities. It is a strategy that these guys have been using successfully for nearly a decade now. I've known these guys for 6 or 7 years. They're personal friends of mine. Not only do they offer the Steam Room where they keep you up to date on money coming into the options market, but they also are offering a master course to learn tape reading and market psychology and something called the 3LT Playbook, which is Lucci's three rules that have made him a successful trader over the last decade or so. Check it out. These guys are the real deal. I know them personally. Very good guys. And Charlie Bathgate from Sanglucci will be on this coming month, and I'm super stoked to have him on. He's a great guy. So check out my friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. Those links are also in the podcast description. You can also check out my friends over at Focused Compounding. These guys focus on niche investment ideas, and I want to shout them out. Make sure that you check out their Twitter feed. It's at Focused Compound. That link is in my podcast description. These guys basically spend all their time looking for ideas that nobody else has come across and nobody else has posted about. So check out my friends over at Focused Compounding and follow them on Twitter. It's 100% free to do it. The link is in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Rumorhound. Rumorhound is a brand new piece of AI-based software that looks into rumors on mergers and acquisitions in the market. So you see rumors all the time. Hey, so-and-so is going to take over so-and-so. Perhaps this company is looking for a buyout offer. Perhaps somebody is looking to sell their company. Rumorhound looks at all of these rumors. It looks at the source. It looks at the possible credibility. It looks at the financials behind the company. And through its algorithm, spits out to you whether or not these rumors are something that maybe you should or should not be paying attention to. It is a great tool to have in your toolkit, especially if you're a day trader. Check out rumorhound.ai. Their link is also in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my continual supporters who I appreciate very much. My friends at Hella Bacon that shoot machine guns out of helicopters in Texas. Check them out at Hella Bacon, H-E-L-I-B-A-C-O-N. My friends at Corvus Gold. If you're a gold investor, check out Corvus Gold. My friend Monero, my friend Russ Valenti, who I said again is matching your patrons from now till October 10th for charity. Great guy. Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud, Chris Bede, Ken R., and Chris Boas. Appreciate you guys very much. Gary Wozniak checking in with an edit the other day that I appreciate very much. Ken, Mr. J.K. Cunningham, Stank Love, and Brainerd Ferguson, I appreciate you. And also, I want to shout out some of my newest patrons, people that have become patrons recently. If I say your name here, give yourself a pat on the back. Like my friend Jay, Collins Davis, Creighton Titus, Dennis, and King Cambo, Stephen Hemingway, George Rosansky, thank you very much. And of course, some people that have been with me for a little bit longer, like Gary Dubisky, thank you. My friend Rob Sittig, I appreciate you still. Mason Bustle, thank you for continuing to be a patron. It's very much appreciated. Wolfgang Pipperger, Mike Hanlon, and Jerry Baker, thank you guys very much. I do appreciate it. All right. Genuinely, I do, by the way, my patrons. I appreciate this shit a lot. Keeps me going. All right. Before we get started, I got a badass guest today I'm super stoked about. First and foremost, this podcast is not investment advice. We're not talking about investing today. So if somehow you gain investment advice from this, you're a fucking idiot. It's that simple. And finally, and I mean that in the nicest way possible, thank you for listening is what I'm trying to say. Also, this podcast requires a 2-drink minimum at all times. If you listen to it and it sucks, it's probably because you're not drunk enough. It's that simple. I need the equivalent of beer goggles for listeners' ears all the time with this podcast. And now, without further ado, the time spot you have likely jumped to if you're listening on YouTube, let's get started with the podcast. All right, on the line with me today, I'm so stoked to do this interview today. I really am, because this is a topic that has fascinated me outside of knowing this gentleman's story for a long time. I have a gentleman named Doug Williams, who is a ex-police detective who actually wound up going to prison for teaching people how to beat polygraph exams. And Mr. Williams here has dedicated his life, his website, polygraph.com, he has dedicated his life to trying to teach people about the inefficiencies of polygraphs and basically why they're flawed. There was a fantastic Bloomberg article on him called Man vs. Machine, The True Story of an Ex-Cop's War on Lie Detectors from August 4th, 2015, which is a great read that I would encourage you guys to check out on your own time, of course. Now, I would like to welcome Mr. Doug Williams. What's going on, brother?
Hey, Chris. Good to visit with you.
It is. Thank you so much for taking the interview without knowing anything about me at all and on a whim.
Well, I made it a rule. I've been doing this now for 40 years. Actually been involved in polygraph for about almost 50 years, both on one side or the other. But I made it a rule to always take interviews to talk to whoever wants to talk about the subject, because I am so far behind the curve on this propaganda stuff that I have to take every opportunity to tell the truth about the so-called lie detector, because all the thugs and charlatans in the polygraph industry, they've got a lot bigger megaphone than I do.
Yeah, and certainly this is a topic that I've found fascinating for a long time, dating back to, probably like 5 or 6 years ago. I saw a documentary somewhere, probably on YouTube, and watched a couple of polygraph examiners give polygraphs. It was these, guys that they hired to find out whether or not your wife is cheating on you and shit like that. And I listened to how these guys were, you know, phrasing their questions and how aggressive and intimidating they were. They were all, you know, bald, kind of cock diesel looking military style guys, you know, just scaring the fuck out of people, of course. And I was like, man, something about this doesn't gel here. So I'm fascinated to hear your story wherever you would like to start. And we have as much time as possible. So if you would like to start from the beginning and go, you're more than welcome.
Okay, Chris. Yeah, it's kind of a hard situation to encapsulate it. But I started off in the polygraph business back in 1972. I was a police officer with the Oklahoma City Police Department, had probably 3 or 4 years on the job, maybe about 2 or 3, I guess. Anyway, I see a notice on the bulletin board that they're accepting applications for a polygraph operator, and that this position came with an automatic rank of sergeant. Well, I knew it'd take me quite a while. I just barely had made detective, and I figured it'd take me quite a while to make sergeant, but this might be a quick way to jump. So I put in my application for it and went to great lengths of preparing for the interview. I memorized all the possible questions that could be asked of me, and spent literally hours in front of a mirror answering those questions, and evidently did a pretty good job of impressing the staff, and was ultimately sent to the polygraph school in 1972. They sent me to the National Training Center of Lie Detection in New York City. It was basically really quite an eye-opener. I had had one previous experience with a polygraph prior to that. Well, actually two. One was while I was in the service, I had a very high security clearance, worked in the White House Situation Room and handled all the eyes only for the president messages from 1966 to 1969 before I was discharged from the military. Anyway, prior to becoming sent to that assignment, I was given a polygraph examination by the CIA, and it really was quite a traumatic experience in a lot of ways, and it stayed with me. Then also, I was given another polygraph examination prior to joining the police department, a pre-employment polygraph examination. So I had had very limited experience with the polygraph, but I was like everybody else. I thought, well, I must have been telling the truth because I passed, or I passed because I was telling the truth. I don't know which came first. But anyway, we go in there, and I'm at this polygraph school, and the very first day, they start talking about how they presume to say. I always thought there was a lot more to that. So I get in this class, and these guys they got this machine up there, this little instrument, and it's capable of doing three things. It can watch you breathe, watch your heartbeat, and watch two fingers on your right hand sweat. That's it. They put pneumograph tubes around your chest and stomach, watch you breathe, put a cardio cup on your left arm and watch your heartbeat. And then they put GSR attachments on the finger, first and third fingers of your right hand and monitor your sweat activity. And from that, they presume to be able to detect deception. Well, that sounded awful strange to me right off the bat. I thought, damn, is that all that thing records? And so anyway, we get to going through, and then they say, okay, well, here's how the polygraph works. Well, okay, here now I'm going to find out how it really works. And so all my doubts will be cast aside, and I will be a firm believer in the validity. So here we go. Here is the theory behind the polygraph that has not changed significantly, if at all, since it was invented in 1921. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Polygraph measures what's known as the fight or flight response, which is basically your body's reaction to a stress situation. In other words, when you're confronted with a stressful situation, your body shoots a little shot of adrenaline in your system, and you have the decision then to make whether you're going to fight this stimulus that's frightening you or flee from it.
Right.
Those are your only two options. Okay. Now, so here we go. Here's this polygraph guy. He's coming in, and he's asking you all these questions. Now, if you have a nervous reaction, which basically they claim is a lying reaction. Now, here's what this lying reaction is. It's an increase or decrease in the sweat activity in your hand, an erratic breathing pattern, and an increase in blood pressure and pulse rate. So basically, you start to breathe a little erratically, and your heart starts to race a little rapidly, and you get a little sweaty on your hands. Now, when you have that reaction, if you have that reaction to what's called a relevant question, then they say that you have lied. Now, so here's the problem. So they say, okay, well, I said, well, that makes kind of sort of sense. Let's see now. So we have relevant, here's how we do it then. So we measure reactions. It's just a measuring reactions, difference in reactions between what's called the relevant questions and the control questions. So I'm thinking, okay, well, we might be onto something here. This thing might actually work. So here he goes, and he gives us all this explanation about these questions that you ask people. Okay, so here we've got a very important situation coming up here. Actually, Chris, just put yourself in this situation. You go home this evening, and the police are at the door. They say, "Okay, sir, we're going to have to take you in." And the next door neighbor, Susie, has alleged that you have molested her. And so we're going to have to take you in. Now we'll offer you the chance to take a polygraph test to clear your name if you like. So here we're going to go. Now, here's the polygraph test, Chris. You're going to be taking this polygraph test now. Now, relevant questions are going to be all the things associated with, did you molest Susie? We're going to go through all things that constitute a molestation. We need not get into all the sordid details, but you have an idea of what I'm talking about. They will then intersperse what they call control questions. Questions such as, have you ever lied to anyone to keep from getting in trouble? Have you ever deliberately hurt anyone? And then they'll intersperse those in. And so the theory behind the polygraph then, Chris, is they're going to ask you these questions regarding molesting Susie, and then they're going to intersperse with those questions regarding molesting Susie questions about whether you have ever deliberately lied to anyone to keep from getting in trouble. Now, immediately my radar went up on that because I start thinking to myself, self, we're mixing apples and oranges here. There's just no way you can possibly compose a control question that has the same emotional impact as a relevant question. Right. Therefore, it is impossible to fairly compare the two. That's what the polygraph does. So my big hope then that it would have some degree of accuracy or validity was dashed. So then we get into the 99% of the time we spent in that school, which is interrogation techniques. And buddy, did I learn some interrogation techniques. They then presented me with my polygraph when I got back to the police department, and I had myself one hell of a psychological billy club that I could use to coerce confessions out of many, many people, which
I
did.
I bet.
So I was real successful at what I did, but I knew from the get-go that there ain't no such thing as a fucking lie detector.
The fascinating thing from the documentary I had watched and some of the examples I had watched was 8 out of 10 times when they catch somebody lying, they had them confess just under the pressure of being on the machine. So it was this, like you're saying, it was these interrogation techniques and this repetitive kind of, you know, good cop, bad cop, you know, all the shit that police officers do, obviously, because you were an ex-police officer, you know, this kind of good cop, bad cop, help me out here. And then if that doesn't work, you know, well, I already know the answer, so you might as well tell me, that kind of shit. And 8 out of 10 times, you know, the poor sap taking the test would just crumble under the pressure. I went to a strip club once, you know, and I didn't tell my wife. I was like, yeah. Oh my God.
You know, we there's a link on my website, polygraph.com. A few years back, we did a deal with Penn and Teller bullshit.
I remember that.
A situation similar to that where it just showed. And what they did on
That might have been exactly what I'm referring to, because I used to watch that show all the time. That may have been exactly what I watched.
Yeah, that was a good episode. They did a real good job, and it really showed what a piece of shit the polygraph guy is. I mean, he took that.
Yep.
and see that, and that's the thing about that is very, very much like the way the polygraph examiners are. They're when I refer to them as thugs and charlatans, that is exactly what they are. They are thugs and charlatans. They are perpetrating a fraud, a massive evil fraud, and they don't give a damn how many people get hurt by perpetrating this fraud,
right,
as long as they can unjustly enrich themselves. You understand that the polygraph industry in the United States government is a $4 billion, with a B, $4 billion a year industry.
Yeah, I do now.
it's ridiculous. It is absolutely absurd.
Yeah, well,
we're spending all that money and we're risking our national security on a piece of shit that does not fucking work.
Well, and it's you can look at it that way, certainly. I mean, the thing's been around for 100 years now, but also you can look at, just to go back to what you were saying about that episode, I think that's exactly what I saw. And I remember, you know, that was what they coerced out of that guy, like that he had been to a strip club or something and didn't tell his wife, or like, you know, touched a stripper once or something. And you just think, like, as a human being, like, what, like, why would you? I mean, if the wife didn't hire you and wasn't paying you money to do that, like, what kind of a person would do that to somebody else? Like, it's not your business, number one, but ethically, it's like, I don't know. Like, it is kind of an icky feeling, man.
Yeah, there's some low-life scums in that business, and they have no redeeming social value. When you boil them down to it, as to the utility of the polygraph, it's just like I said at the beginning. It is nothing but a psychological billy club that will coerce a person into a confession. Now, there are people who need to be beat up and confessing, and I guess polygraphs are about as good a way as any. But let's don't sit there. Now, see, here's my biggest problem with it. It's with this damn pre-employment stuff, and that's what they came after me on, because I was helping people learn how to pass a pre-employment polygraph examination to get a job. Simply because if you don't prepare for it, you have a 70% chance of failing. 70% of the people who go to apply for jobs with the government are denied employment based solely on a failed polygraph examination. And not only do they not get that job, they are blackballed and not allowed to apply ever again because this polygraph operator claimed they lied. That's ridiculous.
And in your opinion, what percentage of those 70% that are denied do you think are probably telling the truth?
Who knows? But when you have a situation, see, that's the whole point. That tactically, they made a very, the thugs and charlatans in the polygraph industry made a very grave tactical error when they prosecuted me for teaching someone how to beat it. Because if you stop and think about it, that prosecution is tantamount to them admitting that the polygraph is absolutely worthless as a lie detector. Now, if I can teach a person how to control every tracing on the polygraph chart and produce a perfect truthful chart regardless of whether they're telling the truth or not, that is prima facie evidence the polygraph is absolutely worthless as a lie detector. And for them to continue to perpetrate this fraud knowing that it's a fraud and already having admitted that it's a fraud, I think it's what my goal is now. I mean, I got the shaft. I got an attorney whatever. The whole story is, but the fact of the matter is, my mere prosecution is proof that I have been telling the truth about the polygraph all these years, and they have been lying, because I have always said that I can teach a person how to beat the test, therefore proving it is worthless. They have always said I cannot do that, right up until the day they prosecuted me for doing it.
So what was that like? What happened?
I was in a normal training session. I had my own little business. I had a pretty good little business going there. I'd have people come in. If they came to me, I'd charge them $1,000 and run them through an actual polygraph test using the actual polygraph questions that they'll be asked on the test, whether it's pre-employment, whatever it is. And then I'd run it through the scoring algorithm on my computerized polygraph instrument, and then show them how easy it is to pass by simply understanding the difference between the relevant and the control questions, and forcing yourself to think of something frightening on the control questions and thinking of something relaxing on the relevant questions. It's ridiculously simple to beat the damn thing. It's just basically mastering a very simple biofeedback mechanism. I took a relaxation exercise from the Lamaze natural childbirth and adapted that to teach people how to relax when they enter a relevant question on a polygraph test. It's so absurdly ridiculous. And then they sent in a ringer and he supposedly, he never did really lie or tell me he was going to lie, and I never told him to lie, but they claimed I did. And anyway, we go, I get this piece of crap attorney, and we go to lunch on the first day, first full day of trial. The only thing that really happened was that they played a tape of me training this guy how to beat a polygraph test in open court, which was the main thing I wanted to accomplish by going to court in the first place, was making them sit there in open court and publicly air a training exercise for everybody that wanted to listen to it, how to beat a polygraph test, the very thing they're throwing me in prison for doing, which, by the way, is also the same thing I testified to in Congress in 1985. That's another story. So anyway, we go in there to go to lunch at, on after.
Wait, what is the statute there? Is it illegal to teach somebody how to beat a polygraph
test? Oh, no.
What is the statute? What are they actually charging?
No, they couldn't do that. There's no law against that. No, so they had to turn around and say that it's witness tampering.
Oh, fuck off. Really?
Yeah. And then they charged me 2 counts of witness tampering and 3 counts of mail fraud because I got my retainer through the mail. Now, I can understand if I was not able to teach a person how to beat a polygraph test and claim that I was,
right,
then that would be fraud. But since I was able to do it, how could that be fraud?
And essentially, you're just the other side of the coin, right? So what you have objectively, when you look at it from the outside in as an outside observer, right, you have an individual that's going to need to sit attached, hooked up to this machine for a certain point of time, and you have a person that's going to administer the test and is going to administer the interrogation. Now, what is to stop that person from being fully informed about public knowledge that is completely legal to understand about the process they'll be going through, the interrogation they'll be going through, and the machine they're hooked up to? There's nothing illegal about that. That's called being well informed, right?
I wish I had fired my fucking lawyer and hired you.
Oh, dude, I would have held it down. You kidding me? Did you ever see My Cousin Vinny?
Yeah, there you go. But you know, that's okay. So they got me. They came along and they got me. And my piece of crap lawyer tells me at lunch on the first day of trial, we go to lunch, and he's almost crying. He says, "I don't know how to offer a defense." And I said, "Man, that's a hell of a time to be telling me that."
Oh my God.
And so we go back and I said, "Well, go back and make the best deal you can." And, you know, in truth and in fact, I will have to admit that I really was not in any position to effectively assist in my own defense. I'm telling you the truth, Chris. When they came in there busting in, I was doing a normal training session. I was in there with my little polygraph showing the guy how to pass the damn test. And here, 5 fucking agents busted into a 8x10 room. We could barely stand shoulder to shoulder in there. They jammed me up against the wall. I have a concealed weapons permit or open carry permit then. They grabbed my gun and all kind of threw me up against the wall, handcuffed me, all kind of crap. And I could not even understand why. I couldn't. What is going on? What could I possibly have done? And anyway, long story short, it goes on and on. Finally, goes through the trial, and goes through the bullshit. I go do my 21 months in prison and all that. And it's just all bullshit. It's just all bullshit. In fact, the thugs and charlatans behind this whole thing. If I were making a bunch of money again, or a bunch of money, period. I'm gonna hire me a good investigative reporter and get to the bottom of all this. But this Operation Liebusters, the case they had against me is unbelievable. It's like they came out and publicly said a newspaper article. I've got tons of newspaper articles. They were listed right there on my website, polygraph.com, telling all about how they came out publicly and stated that they were going after me because I had protested the loudest and the longest against the polygraph. And then, by God, they manufactured a crime, set me up, prosecuted me, and threw me in prison. And the only thing I did was teach a person how to control their breathing and relax on a relevant question and think of something frightening on a control question. No, I kept thinking when this first happened, I said, "Sure, you know what I kept waiting for, Chris? I kept waiting for Tvor."
What were you waiting for?
Tvor, T-V-O-R. Oh. You know, it's an acronym for the voice of reason. Ah. I kept waiting for the voice of reason.
Right.
Surely somewhere somebody's going to say, what the fuck are you doing? You're going to bring a case like this into my courtroom? He's witness tampering. What are they witness to? They're lying about everything. They're not applying for a job. They're lying about everything. And Mr. Williams never told them to lie. In fact, they came in there and got the list of 5,000 of my clients, sent 100 agents out all from 30 different federal agencies all across the country for a period of 2 years interviewing these people, and not one person ever said that I told them to lie, or that they told me to lie, or that they told me they were going to lie. So they ended up having to manufacture the crime by bringing somebody in there to lie about lying.
What year was that you went to trial, and when did you go to prison?
I went to prison in 2017, and the trial was about a year or so before that. It's all the dates and everything are in the fact. It would be a very interesting exercise if somebody was so inclined to go in there and look in on my website and then go on Pacer. And I went crazy on mine when I was in prison. I did a bunch of pro se motions, and then when I got out, I appealed it all the way to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals and everything else.
So what did you do after you got out? Did you go back to work?
No, I can't. I'm still got 10 more months left on my supervised release. I had 3 years of probation, what they call supervised release, where I am prohibited from any form of polygraph-related activity.
Well, what about this interview? Doesn't that count?
Nope. No, I guess what I narrowed it down through a series of motions and stuff to try to figure out what exactly that meant. But basically, it meant that I can't be demonstrating with a polygraph instrument from what I've been given to understand. But they could probably, I suppose they could throw me in prison for that. They threw me in prison for nothing in the first place, didn't they?
It's very interesting. It's what are your plans after your supervised release?
Well, right now I'm in the process of getting a book published that tells the whole story. It's a book titled False Confessions. It tells about my 40-year crusade. I met a guy in prison by the name of Jack Straw who helped. I had written a little book before I went in called telling about my crusade and everything, and self-published it on Amazon. It didn't really amount to anything, but when I was in prison, I had this, everybody'd come around and say, you know, what you in here for and all that. And as you well know, my story is somewhat convoluted. So I had my wife send me some of those books that I had self-published, and when these guys had come around asking what you're in for, I'd just give them a book.
Right.
And a few years, 2 days later, they'd come back, or a week or whatever. Man, he said, I know what I'm in here for. I'm selling drugs, or I didn't pay my taxes, or whatever. I can't figure out what you're in here for. And I'd say, well, it was witness tampering. I said, what? Anyway, long story. But anyway, one of the guys I gave the book to was a fellow by the name of Jack Straw. He's quite a character. He was the youngest police captain in Chicago Police Department at the time. And anyway, got his own business and got in trouble for embezzling from his own business. Long story. But anyway, he was locked up at the same time I was, and he read the book, and he came back around to my cell after he'd read it, and he said, man, he said, this is a hell of a story. He said, it's like a 200-page police report. He said, I got some skill at writing. I think I can make this into a book that people actually read, because people ain't going to read a 200-page police report. Anyway, he did a real good job, and we've got publishers looking at it now, and agents looking at it, and what have you. So you never know what's going to happen on that, but my primary goal right now, of course, once my probation period's up, I will immediately get back to teaching people how to pass polygraph tests. Double dog dare the government to do anything about it. But right now, my primary goal is to try to get some big law firms to help me
file some class action, maybe even some individual lawsuits on behalf of the polygraph victims. I've got a little page on my website, polygraph.com, that called Sue the Bastards. And I would love for anybody that's an attorney or anything like that to look that over and see, I think I'm on to something here, because as I tried to touch on in that web page is, if I can, like we discussed earlier, if the mere fact that they prosecuted me for teaching people how to beat it tends to me to prove that it's worthless, and them knowing it's worthless and continuing to use it tends to make me think that they're knowingly perpetrating fraud. And when people are damaged by a federal official knowingly perpetrating fraud, I think they might be entitled to damages. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but I think if we can get us a good bad breath to lawyer and sue the bastards, we might actually put them out of business.
So when you were going through learning about the interrogation techniques, I mean, what were some of the things that they taught you? I mean, what were some of the, like, dirtiest tricks?
Well, they really weren't any of them all that dirty. It's just play the situation as it comes, so to speak. Each person's individual and each person's different, but I had a real knack for it for some reason. I could read people really, really quick, and I could get in there and be the. I could go to church with them, or I could pray with them, or I could be a priest, or I could scare the hell out of them, whatever they needed to get them to talk.
Right.
I was pretty good at doing that. Some of the stuff they taught in school were kind of campy, but it was they were just basically one was, I never did really try it that much, but it was old Dick Arthur was the guy that was running the school. He was a real character. He has some interrogation techniques that were just almost comical, but the way he used it, because people would confess because they were scared the crazy bastard was going to really kill them or something.
Yeah, do you think you could move a little bit closer to your phone again from maybe like where you were like 5 minutes ago? Because I'm just having a little bit more trouble hearing you now.
Oh, okay. Hold on a second. Is that better?
That's much better.
Okay.
That's perfect. So when you were interrogated by the CIA, or not interrogated, when you had to take the polygraph for the CIA, so you were in the White House. Is that what you said earlier?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So what was that experience like going through the polygraph with the CIA?
It really wasn't that big of a deal. It was kind of anticlimactic. I didn't even know I was going to be taking it. I had a security clearance. When I went in January of 66, and we went through boot camp, and then they started sending us to these tech schools. And I'd go through, the first one I went to was like what they call a pole climber, climb these damn poles and splice cable and all that crap. And well, this was 1966, and in Vietnam, they were just starting, and they didn't have any facilities, so everybody was building stuff from the ground up. So they were teaching us how to like the spring cable and all that, because I was assigned to the communications. So anyway, we get through this pole climbing school, and all 30 or 40 of them haul ass, and they get sent straight to Vietnam. And my orders are redlined, which meant that I was just held over on the base, and they sent me to another tech school, teletype repair, and then finished that, and then everybody was sent off to Vietnam, except me. And then I was redlined and sent to another tech school. This went on for 8-9 months, and we kept one tech school after another. Finally, after about 3 or 4 months, I get called into the CO's office, and tells me that there are people out there want to talk to me, and guys in civilian clothes and all that. So anyway, I go outside and come with me. Three guys in civilian clothes take me to a room, inside of a room, and give me what they call a watch line, where you could call anywhere in the world. And anyway, so I tell me to fill out this form. Long story short, I fill out this 48-page form. They started a security clearance investigation on me, and 4 months later, they come back in there and tell me, okay, here's, you passed, you're going to the White House, blah, blah, blah. Don't wear your uniform. Here's money for a civilian clothes. Here's a number to call when you get there. We're going to pick you up, blah, blah, blah. So I said, okey-doo. So away we go, because the alternative, of course, is Vietnam. And I thought, well, and I'm doing pretty good here. And so anyway, I go down there, and I arrive in Vietnam, in D.C. I call this number, and I'm picked up by this limo and take me over to this big underground place over in Georgetown. Tell me to go in that door. So I grab my gear and go in that door. And the end of the hall, there's a guy sitting there by a polygraph. Says, come with me. There's a big old beer cut guy. Got a 45 sitting on the desk. He tells me, okay, now we're going to take a polygraph test here. And one or two things are going to happen. Either you're going to pass, and you can go on over there and work in the White House, or you ain't going to pass, and I'm going to take this 45 and blow your fucking head off.
Lovely.
I was 21 years old.
Lovely.
And I believed that he would do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my CIA polygraph.
Well, that doesn't sound very anticlimactic and no big deal as you put it off. It sounds like fucking frightening.
Well, but little did I know that compared to what would follow over the next years, that would be rather anticlimactic by comparison.
Well, what else? What are some other examples that make that pale in comparison?
Well, for more of the exciting adventures of Doug Williams, Crusader, keep watching for Case Confessions coming soon.
So, do you have one or two stories though that you can share where, you know, you feel like somebody was wronged from the polygraph, or some of the more egregious examples?
Oh man, that get me started on that. We'll be Guinness Book of World Records time.
Well, you got it. You have to go through a couple of the ones that stand out in your mind the most, right?
Well, there's there's just so many of them, and they range from tragic to almost like comical. They're so ridiculous, but some of them are. I think whether it's the most egregious.
Yeah.
It's not so much egregious as it is just an example of the same old tired bullshit that these guys do pull all the time. The polygraph guys, I mean, they are nothing but frauds and con men. Well, okay, here's one guy. It wasn't that long ago. I get a call from a Coast Guard commander. He got a promotion, or was in line for a promotion to move up in his job, but that he had to get a higher security clearance, which would necessitate him getting a new polygraph examination. So he said, oh, it's no big deal to me, sure. So he goes to the appointed polygraph time and goes through the questions and everything. And, of course, those things last forever, and they ask all kind of questions. But he was asked one question in particular that kind of made me wonder. He said, they asked me if I'd ever mishandled classified information. Yeah, he said, they asked me if I'd ever mishandled classified information. He said, no. He said, I've been very circumspect about that in my career. He said, at that very moment, it flashed in my mind that about a week or so ago, I had exchanged my work briefcase for a new briefcase. In other words, he said, my briefcase that I had all at work with all the classified information in it was getting tattered. So I brought a new briefcase from home and just was exchanging things. He said, I took all the stuff from my work briefcase and put it in the new briefcase, and all the stuff from my new briefcase I put in the old briefcase and took it home. He said, when I got home, I saw a cover sheet But I've seen hundreds of them. They're just a black piece of paper with a diagonal red stripe that says either secret or top secret or whatever on it. Nothing. All that indicates is that below that is classified information.
Okay.
And he said, I didn't know. I just picked it up and threw it in the trash. He said, I told the guy about that. There's nothing. It's a cover sheet. It means nothing. He said, so I went on about my business thinking everything is fine. He said, I go back to work the next morning. My boss calls me in. We got a problem. He says, what? He says, phonograph guy says you have admitted to mishandling classified information. And he said, I most certainly have not. I did not. I told him what I told the phonograph guy. He says, well, that's not what the guy said. He said, well, I want to appeal. He said, you can't appeal. Decision made. Not only are you not getting the promotion, you'll be lucky to finish your career. This is a man who had 18 years in service.
Right.
His career is jeopardized because some thug made up a story just to make himself look good.
Right. To make himself look like he was,
doing
something.
At,
right.
Look at what I caught. Oh, we caught a super pie here.
Right. Right. Yep. And that goes back to, you know, again, like that episode of Penn and Teller bullshit, when they just, you know, the way that they were positioning the questions to these guys were just relentless. And again, the one guy, they were trying to figure out on his bachelor party, you know, if he had done anything that, you know, it wasn't supposed to do or whatever. And it's just comical. There's a link to the episode, actually. It's on your website. So if you go to Doug's website, polygraph.com, there's a link there to the bullshit episode. And you'll see the guy talking, and the way he changes his tone to this guy, Doug, he first comes at him with like, hey, you know, Steve, hey, we've all been to bachelor parties, you know, I think everybody knows what goes on there, you know, hey, come on, buddy, you tell me, did you have your hand near a tit, did you look at a tit, maybe, you know, did you breathe close to a tit, did you, you know, were you in the same room as a woman's ass, you know, kind of like this stupid, like, good cop, bad cop thing, and then he'll shift gears, and he'll be like, you know, we know you looked at the nipple, you know, turn your head away when you could have. Like, it's just so fucking insane. The excruciating minutiae that these guys latch onto. And this, what you're talking about, is a perfect example, right? Of taking something out of context to make it look as though you're providing value.
Yes, and even to the extent of absolutely fabricating the story so that they can make themselves, I call them scalp hunters. These polygraph thugs are scalp hunters. They get these admissions from people and nail them up on the wall like they're some kind of a scalp hunt that they've taken as a trophy, and it's absurd.
Right.
And people's lives are being ruined, and the only thing that they've done is to somehow ingratiate themselves with their supervisors.
Right,
by saying,
right.
You know, it's just ridiculous. It's beyond ridiculous. It's evil, is what it is.
And
it's
if
evil.
you watch that episode too, when the examiner gets this little nugget of information that, you know, this guy gave a stripper a dollar or whatever the fuck he did, he calls the woman in. Who, by the way, you know, if you're subjecting your significant other to a polygraph test, something's wrong with your fucking relationship to begin with. That's number one. That's a different episode for a different day. But he brings the woman in, Doug. And he, like, you know, he puts his arm around her and he's like, well, you know, I'm sorry, Mary, but Steve admitted to improper sexual conduct with another woman, you know, with this tone of voice. Like, man, it's so great that you had me here. Otherwise, who knows what could have happened to your marriage going forward. And, you know, I was able to ascertain this piece of information. It's like, go fuck yourself. Like, come on.
Yeah, it was maybe he didn't exactly lie, but he certainly embellished what the guy said.
Right, right. Exactly. So, you know, when anybody that was having a normal conversation with her would have been like, hey, you know, the guy went to the bachelor party, all right, whatever.
Yeah,
touched
yeah, yeah.
Tip for
yeah,
nine, yeah, 9 seconds,
exactly.
And that was it. You know?
He went to the strip club, and what normally happens at the strip club happened, but nothing else, so don't worry about it.
You know? Exactly! There you go. And so I think that's a great example. I think people should watch that video, too, because now it's starting to come back.
Emblematic of what these assholes are. The thugs and charlatans are in the polygraph industry are... There's just no other word for them. They're evil. Just put yourself in the position of all the people. 70% of the people who go for federal jobs are denied employment. Now, that's a Secret Service, FBI, CIA, and don't forget all the private industry companies who have contracts with the government that require security clearances and polygraph examinations. When they go through there and summarily deny employment based on something that is a fraud, certainly, and I appeal to any lawyers out there who happen to tune into this podcast, get on that website and help me fine-tune this, because, by God, if we can get this going, it will make the tobacco class action lawsuit look like a small claims court.
I know your message is falling on, is resonating with some people, I can tell you that. And we get, you know, usually between 20 and 40,000 listens an episode, so there may be one or two lawyers in there for you, Doug.
Well, all right, I'm telling you. And see, you've got a perfect expert witness here. Who else can prove the polygraph is a fraud better than someone who was imprisoned for teaching someone how to beat it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
and see, if we could get that far, we could take it in there into the courtroom, and I could hook up anybody in that courtroom who would volunteer and teach them how to control every tracing on that chart in 5 minutes or less. Do you think that would be adequate proof that the polygraph's a fraud?
Do I? Yeah, I think so. I mean, what were they teaching in the episode for people to, like, pucker up their buttholes during the control questions, right? To simulate.
Yeah, that was my first technique. I wrote that in 1979. It's called the sting technique.
The what technique?
It's called the sting technique.
The sting?
Yeah, sting. STING. I wrote a manual in 1979 when I left the police department entitled "How to Sting the Polygraph." It gives you the step by step exactly how to beat the test. What's so weird about this with the government? I mean, you'd act like the way they came and prosecuted me, that this was a big fucking surprise to them that I was actually doing this. But the fact of the matter is, I've been doing it since 1979. I've done it on national television numerous times. I testified in Congress in 1985 in support of the Employee Polygraph Protection Act, and explained the technique, the sting technique, step by step in the Congress, and submitted my manual, How to Sting the Polygraph, to the Congress. It is part of the congressional record in 1985. I also gave that manual to the government polygraph school, who has used it to train their polygraph examiners in countermeasures since 1985, and they still use it today. Then they come along and prosecute me for teaching a federal agent exactly the same thing that I testified to in Congress in 1985.
And polygraphs aren't admissible in court, right?
Oh, no, of course not.
Well, that should be all you need. Right? I mean, can't you just go before a court and just say, hey, you know, what's the history of it not being admissible in courts?
Well, basically, they took two things that I said in 1979. Two reasons that polygraph is not admitted in the court, according to the United States Supreme Court. Excuse me. One, goodness gracious. It's easy for a liar to meet it. And two, it's no more accurate than the toss of a coin.
And you were the precedent for making it inadmissible in court?
They took almost direct quote out of my manual One of the justices on the Supreme Court, in deciding in the Schaefer case, is saying the polygraph said, and in quote, polygraph, when used as a lie detector, is no more accurate than the toss of a coin. That is a direct quote from my manual.
And it's just fascinating that if it doesn't hold up to that, you know, burden, right, of being able to be admissible in court, why it's still used for things like you're saying, you know, screening for, you just assume, just interrogate somebody without it, right? I mean, if you want to interrogate somebody, you just interrogate them. You can, you know, interrogate them aggressively, right?
Yeah, but I don't know. Of course, it's a lot of it too is the money. I mean, you got a $4 billion a year industry. That's a lot of money to spread around to politicians and everybody else.
Right.
But that's why I'm so strong now on this lawsuit. If we can get this lawsuit going, we'll put them out of business because they'll be bankrupt.
When you were a detective, did you also, you know, interrogate people without the polygraph?
No, that was my job. I'd use the polygraph for everything.
That was it?
Yeah, I didn't ever go out in the field after I got the polygraph.
Yeah, because one of the, I guess one of the most, I don't know if you've seen it. You haven't seen the Making a Murderer docuseries, have you, on Netflix?
I got that scheduled to be watched, but I hadn't got around to it yet.
Yeah, well, a key point in that documentary is how one of the subjects is interrogated and trying to determine whether or not he implicates himself, you know, through the course of his interrogation. He's somebody with mental health issues and a learning disability, and you watch the video of the guys interrogating him, and it comes very dangerously close to coercion. And many people have argued that it is coercion, so I was going to ask your opinion on that. But have you ever seen any instances of that? And certainly, you're welcome to come back on and talk about that if you do watch it at some point, because I'd love your take on it. Have you ever seen instances of people being coerced through interrogation?
Oh, yeah. I've not only seen them, I've done them. I had one old boy come back 17 times till he got so sick of looking at me, went ahead and confessed.
Really?
Yeah. That's all a polygraph is. It's an interrogation. I remember when I first came in back from polygraph school, I got about the second or third day, and I got called out in the middle of the night. And it was a robbery homicide lieutenant called me out. He said, "We got a suspect in here. I want you to interrogate or run a polygraph test on him." I said, okay. So I get him in there, and we run through the polygraph, and I come out, and well, this is my considered opinion that this man is lying. He's not telling the truth. He was involved in this homicide. And old lieutenant, big old stub of a cigar sticking out of his big old fat jowls, gets right up my face. He says, "Well, hell yes, he's lying. But that is not the point. The point is you're going to go in there and get a confession because that's what you're here for." So 3 hours later, I got a confession.
And how did you do that?
Oh, just hounded him. Well, you can, like I said, you can pray with him. You can scare the shit out of him. You can do everything. The whole thing about the polygraph is designed to coerce and intimidate. I mean, everything about it is designed to coerce and intimidate. For instance, you've got the chair the subject's sitting in.
Right.
You saw the legs off 3 inches. You nail it to the fucking floor. And then when you get ready to interrogate him after you put him through extreme stress for 2 or 3 hours of asking question after question with cardio cuffs strained around his arm about to cut off all the circulation, and then you get around to your interrogation, pull your chair, because your chair wheels around, and it's tall, and you can raise it up real high, and you wheel it around, you can get your knees right up against his knees, and he can't do anything about it, he can't go anywhere, because you're violating his personal space, and ain't a damn thing he can do about it, because his chair is fucking nailed to the floor. Everything about it, the whole thing. You keep the attachments on just so that you can let them feel like there's an electric chair. Uncomfortable. Everything is under your control and nothing is in their control.
Jesus. So, I mean, you have to have a pretty strong stance on the whole waterboarding issue, which is the first thing I thought of just you're talking about, because it sounds like fucking torture, right? I mean,
well, it's the most traumatic experience most people ever undergo.
So, given what you know about that, do you know anything about waterboarding? Do you have an opinion on it?
Some people need waterboarding.
Yeah, but do you think that it elicits, you know, false confessions? The argument, well, the argument is that it elicits more false confessions than it does good, right?
Well, yeah, but it does get some tongues. I know I never went to Vietnam. I was in the White House the whole time, but my brother was a gunner on an armed Huey in Vietnam, right in the middle of Tet in 1967. And you talk about the power of persuasion when you're interrogating people. He said, we went out there, and these CIA guys flew along with us on one of these missions, and he said we went out there on a deal and picked up some BC, three of them. He said, put them on the Huey, and a couple of CIA agents came along with us, and he said it was me and the pilot and the flight engineers all in there. He said, we was flying along. He said, we get in there, and when we picked these CIA guys up, they threw in some sandbags and some 10-foot lengths of rope. He said, what are you doing? He said, so we're going to fly along there going back to Da Nang. And he said, he ties one, there's two of the, three of those VC. And he said, he ties a rope around each one of them's leg and ties the other end of the rope to the sandbag. He starts asking him, well, where's the headquarters, blah, 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 asking him questions. And they wasn't saying anything, so he just picked up sandbag and threw it out. Of course, the VC flew right along behind it. And he was screaming, hollering, and he said, well, they all got real talkative after that. The other two did, and he said, when we got back to the base, he said, that CIA guy says, you didn't see me throw anybody out. He said, all I did was throw a sandbag. Well, they got the other guys thinking, well, that's the thing about polygraph. It's a lot like throwing a guy out with a sandbag. The idea of what could happen, you know.
Well, yeah, and that's why I'm really interested on your opinion on that, you know, because there's a lot of crossover there, right?
Well, yeah, but the thing of it is, you when you get into a desperate situation, I know when I was on the police force, I didn't get in that many fights, but two or three of them were pretty good doozies. And when you're fighting for your life, literally, they're just not really any holds barred thing. I got called in for using excessive force when I was the one that was originally attacked, and the guy took my nightstick away from me and whomped me out and knocked my teeth out and all that. But when I finally got it back, I did whomp on him pretty good.
Right.
Okay. But when I get through and I get my report in and I get called in the next day to my commander's office, and he says, they're going to file a complaint on you for excessive force. And I said, what exactly is excessive force? I said, man, when I was fighting that old boy, if I could find an atom bomb to stick up his ass, I would have done it.
Yeah, absolutely. I know the, and if you're defending yourself, you know, just be thankful that, you know, you were an officer back before cell phone cameras became ubiquitous, because now,
oh man,
I feel like, yeah. You know, I was just recently in Philadelphia. I was downstairs at the train station and talking to a couple of SEPTA police, which is the Southeast Pennsylvania Transportation Authority. And I was talking to them about some people that were loitering and just being a nuisance at the train station. And I was like, hey, I'm like, you know, why don't you guys take these guys in here, you know? And then they're like, well, he's like, you know, we have to be like super careful. We can't even, you know, first off, the mayor, they were complaining about the mayor, who, you know, is not friendly to the police force, I'm guessing. But they also said nowadays you don't even realize, like, you know, every single thing is on camera all the time, and everything gets taken out of context. And sure, you know, you have videos of police officers that are doing tons of things that they shouldn't be doing, planting evidence, shit like that. I mean, that definitely happens. But on the other hand, conversely, You know, I was watching a video yesterday, for instance, on Facebook. Somebody had put something up, police brutality, you know, and basically the video started, you know, and the police officer and this guy were already engaged. They were already grappling, and it ended with the police officer beating the fuck out of him. But, you know, nobody saw what happened before that. Nobody saw what he was there to investigate. Nobody saw what the potential perpetrator had done, whether he hit the police officer first, any of these things, you know. So now you get these little snippets and the people cry, oh, police brutality, you know, and it's just are you thankful that you weren't around when cameras were everywhere?
Oh, man, yeah, for sure. I never did do anything to anybody that didn't attack me first. But
sure.
I'm one of these. In fact, that's what my commander told me. He said, "Man," he said, "you're." He said, "Williams," he said, "you're a strange dude." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "When most people are confronted with something, they have to sit there and decide whether to." The fight or flight, which the switch is switching back and forth. We're going to fight or we're going to sleep. He says, man, he says, you don't ever have to worry about that because you're permanently stuck on fight.
Yeah, well, hey, at least you know you're on your toes, right? Which you need to.
Well, it's just the way it is. I mean, in my experience, a lot of times, one of those old sayings, too, he who hesitates is lost.
Right.
You don't have a lot of time to decide what you're going to do in certain situations. You either do it or you fucking wish you had.
Well, and I think that's a big contextual part of the debate about, you know, police in the country that a lot of people miss, which is, you know, if you're making a traffic stop and, you know, you approach a vehicle, you know, you don't know, like you're saying, you don't know who the person is. You don't know. Say you're going after a stolen vehicle and you stop a vehicle. I mean, you know, you have to be on your guard. You have to be, you know. And so I understand police needing to be preemptive in a lot of situations. Hey, it's just, you know, when I go compete in a jiu-jitsu tournament, Doug, my coach always tells me the same thing, which is be first. That's what he always says to me. He says, be first, you know, because either I'm going to get on top of the guy and I'm going to set the tone for the match, or he is. And it's the same type of psychology, right? And as a police officer, you're going after the bad guy. So you don't know if you're pulling me over and the car's been reported as stolen because, you know, it's a mix up between me and my girlfriend and, oh, she's actually lent me the car for the weekend, or whether I'm, you know, whether I've stolen the vehicle legitimately and I'm carrying and, you know, and I'm prepared to take it as far as I want to because shit's just not going right in my life. So I think, you know, police have to be preemptive to some degree, right?
Oh, yeah. And I would hate to be a cop nowadays. When I was a cop, and of course, I didn't do that much on the streets. Most of my time was spent in the office or whatever, but I did a couple of years in patrolling, so I had some experience on the streets. And but I didn't take any chances. I didn't fuck around with I assumed that every son of a bitch out there was going to kill me if I didn't watch it. Back to I bought me a little Derringer, little two shot Derringer over and under.
Yeah, I know those.
And I welded that little son of a bitch to the bottom of my metal ticket book. And then whenever I was standing there writing a ticket, unbeknownst to them, I held that Derringer right there on their ass with a hammer back, writing that ticket right there. If anything ever happened, I ain't writing a ticket on your ass. I'm holding the gun on your ass.
What was it, like a little, like 22?
No, a little, I think it was a 32.
Yeah, I've seen those. They literally, yeah. They're like, they look like old, like 1920s.
That's exactly what it was. I just shaved. I just took it down to the metal shop and planed off the top of it and welded it. Actually, soldered it to the ticket book. And then I just sat there and it looked like just a handle. If you looked at it, looked like I'm holding the handle on the bottom of the ticket book and writing the ticket. But actually, it was a a little Derringer that was welded to the bottom of the ticket booth.
Well, thank fuck it didn't go off, you know, for somebody just speeding, going 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, huh?
No, it had about probably 7 or 8 pound trigger pull, so it wouldn't have gone off that easy.
Right, right, yeah. And those things, they're made out of like cast iron, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's wild. What were some of the other like craziest experiences while you were on patrol? Anything ridiculous?
Not really that much. I caught an armed robber single handedly. Not didn't mean to, but I ended up doing it that way. In fact, I got a newspaper article written about it when I was on the front page holding that shotgun I took from that guy. But we had I was actually eating at a fast food joint down there in Oklahoma City, in downtown Oklahoma City on Plassen, which was right in the middle of my district. And I get a call on the radio from my buddy of mine, Royce Robinson, that said that there was an armed robber that just hit the milk jug. It was a little convenience store there on Plassen, that he was heading south on Plassen in a 1965 Chevelle. So I just dumped my Sonic burger out and fired out the old scout car and headed up north on Plassen. And sure enough, here that son of a bitch comes. So I shoot at you and get in behind him. I'm trying to get on the radio to get some help. And I got some Robert Woods was running wants and warrants on a traffic stop and would not break. And I could not get on the air. So I went ahead and waited to try to find, finally got the guy pulled over on an underpass underneath the Interstate 40 and started to get out of the scout. In fact, I just barely got out of the scout car and there he was. He jumped out of that car, had a 20-gauge shotgun, pump shotgun, sawed off, leveled right at me. Now, I mean, it was like, you talking, now this is going to sound weird, but it truly did happen, and I know I'm going to be branded now as some kind of a fucking, who knows, but I'm already a nut anyway. Hell, I'm a fucking felon. What else, how bad could it get? So anyway...
So, yeah, at least you got a good attitude about it, Doug.
So anyway, as soon as this guy jumps out and pulls this shotgun on me, I am having, literally, this is true, and I proved it to myself later, and I'll tell you later how. I had an out-of-body experience. I was up above looking down on these two guys, me and this armed robber, and I really didn't care how it came out. I was just kind of curious, how's it going to come out? So I was sitting there listening to myself talk to this guy, and I was telling this guy, oh, man, I wasn't begging for my life. I was begging for his. I said, oh, man, don't make me shoot you over this. I said, there's no need for you to die over this. I don't want to kill you. Throw that gun back in there, and let's get on and get this straightened out here. And he looked at me kind of crazy, like, he said, you'll make hamburger out of your ass. And I said, no. Well, I said, I got my gun here in my right hand. And I said, I'll put one between your eyes before you can rack that thing back. And it made him think for a second, just a second, whether he did or did not rack a round into that shotgun.
Right.
And that gave me just enough to say, put it up. And that moment of indecision, he thought, well, better. So he threw the gun down. Surprising to me, I didn't have my gun out, nothing. And so I went and handcuffed his ass and took him to jail. But so later on, talking about the out-of-body experience, I'm going down to the underground area there at the station getting some gas in the scout car. And I'm thinking about what happened on that. Now, this is after I'd made the reports and booked the guy into jail and all that crap. And I'm sitting there thinking about what happened. Man, I do remember when I was up there that I was so unconcerned about the outcome that I happened to notice that there was a triangular break in my overhead light. And I made a note to myself that I need to get that fixed or water will get in there and ruin those rotors for my emergency lights. That's how unconcerned I was about what was going to happen down below. So anyway, I go back. Then I get out of the scout car. I had to climb up on the trunk and look down on the scout car to see it. But there it was, one triangle break right where I thought it was.
Oh, that's weird.
Really?
Yeah, that's fascinating. And there could have been no other way that you would have known about it?
No, how else?
I don't know. I don't know. That's wild, though. I mean, certainly that's when you hear about people having like these out-of-body experiences, you know, are points of, you know, extraordinary stress, and people say they see their life flash before their eyes, you know, which is interesting going back to our discussion on waterboarding, which I keep bringing up because, you know, anybody that's put in a situation where, you know, they're choking or it feels like they're drowning and they can't do anything, I mean, they experience some of those emotions. And obviously it's something that I had a similar experience with at some point in history. I won't go into the details, but it scared the ever-loving fuck out of me. And it's in the stress level that goes through your body and what happens to you when you, and I'm not talking about a panic attack, you know, I'm talking about the feeling of, if this doesn't get better very, very soon, I'm actually going to die. What goes through your mind and what goes through your body, it's a really an interesting experience. It's very strange. And that's when you hear about people having these types of experiences like you're talking about, right? These points of like extreme stress or, you know, facing death, looking at death. And it's fascinating that you were able to stay calm and that happened.
Well, yeah, but you know, I've been through a bunch of stuff and I've never experienced anything quite to that degree, but I believe in a hereafter and all that. So it's not really something that is surprising to me. It's just surprising that I actually experienced it. And right. it's almost, and I hardly ever tell anybody about it. Of course, now I've told hundreds and thousands or whoever, but because of what it makes people think about you when you
sure.
do that.
Yep.
But it's just, the fact is a fact. I mean, and it really, I'll be 74 years old Sunday, and I'm to the point where I have really got the key to mental health, and that is a well-developed, don't give a shit attitude.
I think a lot of what you say is 100% right, because people that have suffered from mental health issues, you know, and I speak not entirely out of school because, you know, I dealt with issues for a long time. I dealt with, you know, I went to therapy, I dealt with severe anxiety, I dealt with panic disorder. And a lot of what has helped me cope with that is the idea of surrendering, to your fate, whether it's in a religious sense, whether it's in a, you know, like you're saying, the situation is going to play out however, whether it means accepting, you know, some type of God, whether it means accepting that our fate is already predetermined. The one key factor that kind of ties all these together, and the experiences that I've been lucky enough to have talking to people and my friends and the people that have stepped out of their way to help me, you know, in times when I needed help, the one common denominator between those things was the idea of, you know, surrendering. That's the word that continues to come up. And if you listen to guys like Dan Harris, who's a big proponent of meditation, and his partner that he wrote his book with, I forget his name, but, you know, that's one of the things that he always says, you know, surrender. And so I don't think you're off base, man. I don't think you're off base at all. I think,
well, yeah, that's because I'm a believer, a Christian, so but that's the basis of that too. And basically, when you surrender it and you believe, regardless of whether it's a power greater than yourself or whatever, what you're actually doing is you're surrendering the illusion that you are actually in control anyway.
Right.
And when you do that. And that's one thing I found out about prison. There are not many things that will come in prison, but I figured out one thing about prison after I'd been there for a little bit. You can't do anything in prison. You can't run a business. You're very limited on who you can talk to. You, of course, can't go anywhere. You're just there. You're not able to respond to anything. So I think to myself, okay, self, since I am not allowed or able in any way to respond to anything, then I can give myself permission to be totally irresponsible without any guilt about it, because that's the whole point of being in prison. I am irresponsible. So I enjoyed about 21 months of just being totally fucking irresponsible.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think the problem is that I think a lot of that idea of giving yourself permission to surrender, like you're talking about, it gets convoluted with, you know, all these other theories and theologies and ideologies, and when in fact it's a relatively simple concept, you know, that you can draw a straight line from, you know, hey, I'm a prison inmate for 21 months and I don't really, you know, I can't do shit, so I'm gonna allow myself to just not do shit and be fine with that and just be okay with that. You can draw a straight line between that and saying, oh, I'm surrendering my life to Christ or to Allah or whatever it is you're into, because you're doing the same thing kind of in principle in both of those situations, which is you're surrendering, you're letting go. And the other interesting tie too is how your mental health ties to your physical health in situations like that. And the stories I've heard from people and stories that I've lived of my physical health improving after my mental health improved.
Oh yeah, there's no question about that. In fact, the Psalms talk about how the joy is like juice to your bones, you know, and strength to your body. There's a lot of correlation between a good attitude and good health, and a bad attitude and bad health. There's no question about that.
Yeah, definitely, because it's you know, it's putting your mind under stress. Even if you don't. You know, you have a negative attitude and you just walk around. It's one of these people that just every day you're just pissed in traffic. You're mean to the guy that you order your coffee from. You know, people, they get so caught up in doing that, they don't even understand that that's how they're living. And so they're in this constant, you know, we talked about fight or flight earlier, which is something that plays a huge role here when you talk about mental health and anxiety. But they're in that constant state. And it's interesting that you talk about breathing earlier, because one of the biggest tools somebody can learn, and really arguably you could say if you want to start from the ground up and kind of how to reboot yourself, is learning how to breathe properly. People don't even think about it, but people breathe out of their, you know, from their diaphragm and they breathe rather from their like upper chest instead of taking full breaths, and that will inadvertently put you into a panic state without you even knowing it. So it's wild. It's wild that all this stuff kind of gels together.
Yeah, it really is. Well, I think we're going to have to move on to a different situation here. But I, Chris, I do appreciate the time and the time and visit with you. And once again, maybe we can get together and I can send you a link to a PDF version of my book, False Confessions. You can look it over when you get a chance, and then we can set up an interview to talk about all that when the book is finally published.
Yeah, that sounds great. And what I'll do is when I post the podcast online today, I'll link to your Twitter feed, if that's okay with you, so that people that listen to the podcast can go right through to your Twitter, and then you can you know, post the corresponding information on there that you'd like people to have a look at. Is that all right with you?
That's great. I appreciate that very much. And hopefully we'll be talking again.
Absolutely. Doug Williams, thank you so much for coming on the show and making time for me today. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Take care, Doug. That was the one, the only, Doug Williams, the man. You heard him here. Man, I know he's got a lot. I could just tell there is a vault of stories in that guy's head that I desperately wanted to tap into. But I told him when we started, I said, hey, man, just cut me off when you're done. He was concerned about how long it was going to be. I said, you know, just when it's time to go, just tell me it's time to go. So hopefully we have Doug back on again and we get to some of those stories. Fascinating interview today. Like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I'll be in Las Vegas for the next 2 weeks, basically. All people that donate to my Patreon to support the podcast, I'll be matching 50% of those patrons, and my friend Russ Valenti will also be matching 50% of those. And we will be taking those matches and donating them to charity. So if you enjoy the podcast, check out Traders for a Cause. That will be the charitable organization that the donations go to. And thank you guys so much for the continued Patreons. But for right now, I'm out of here. Peace.